Well, follow that, I suppose, is the opening line. What I'm going to try and do this morning is to try and talk about Craig really from the twin perspective of an educator and a designer, and to open up some of the themes and ideas which perhaps Michael has already indicated, and I hope some of the contextual material that I'm going to provide won't seem too repetitive. Craig, I think, by reputation, is one of the great transformers of theatre practice. Contentious, elusive, problematic, ambiguous, challenging, innovative, I suspect at times infuriating. He's part of a revolution in theatre, which brings about our contemporary understanding of practice and our contemporary understanding of what we now call scenography. His influence on theatre and the merits of his work, as have already been alluded to, are profoundly contested. But he continues to reverberate, he continues to provoke, as today is certainly good evidence of. Craig's vision of theatre making was, I think, one of ongoing reinvention. To continually turn over the status quo, to look for new truths. It was an endless search for a theatre which is authentic to the maker and authentic to its audience. In Craig's mind, it required a mastery of the multiple domains of theatre: the visual, the performative, the technical, the organisational, as well as an acute engagement with the intangible, the poetic, indeed the spiritual. Craig found the dominant practices of his own time moribund, vulgar, conceptually insensible. He tried to describe a completely new holistic approach to theatre making, which centralised not the actor or the playwright or indeed the spectacle, but achieved a unity of purpose and a unity of vision, which transcended these individual contributions or elements. And in educational terms, really transforms the domain area. Much of the scholarship around Craig has certainly brought an increased transparency to his ideas, which at times have seemed so elusive, so ambiguous. It's possibly true to say, I think, that he commanded more respect in the scholarly community than in the community of practicing designers. Certainly his peers and successors were often highly critical. Lee Simonson, the American designer, writing in a very influential book of its time, The Stage is Set, in 1931, devoted a whole chapter to excoriating Craig's thinking. He went so far as to produce models and technical drawings to dismantle Craig's ideas. Simonson says of Craig, "He doesn't know the theatre, he doesn't understand the theatre, as those who have worked in it and conducted its experiments do. When he makes a pretense of planning the theatre of the future, he has not the architect's gift for visualisation. He doesn't possess the concrete imagination of a director who can organise the elements of a performance into a living whole. His one valid doctrine, the necessity for a single directing mind that can give a production artistic unity, had been enunciated by the Duke of Saxe-Meiningen before Craig wrote or drew a line, and was amplified by Stanislavski while Craig was publishing his pseudo-revolutionary volumes." He goes on, "His one technical innovation, the use of screens, in his own hands became a somewhat clumsy and inflexible formula. His few drawings, whose aesthetic qualities are relevant to the stage, are echoes of an indubitable creator, Adolf Appia. And in every case, they antedate his own. He remains today what he was at the outset of his career, essentially an amateur, radiant but vague, full of glowing possibilities, but possessing so little inherent structure that he cannot himself embody them." Not quite satisfied with that, Simonson concludes, "If Craig had been an innovator, a man of theatre and not a pamphleteer, he would have tackled the problem. Craig has no place in living theatre of today or tomorrow, because the theatre continues to live by remaining a workshop." More recent scholarly inquiry is, one would have to say, a little kinder to Craig, but there remains a clear division, I think, between those who find his record of productions limited and his writing opaque, and who will refer to the many stories of his technical failure, and those for whom he genuinely mapped a new scenography of the 20th century. So where does one begin? Well, perhaps one of the ways in which we can recognise the advent of modern scenography is that we begin to see the emergence of a generation of what I'll call practitioner theorists. People who work highly reflexively, seeing a responsibility in addition to making theatre, to constructing a discourse around scenography. through publications, pamphlets, exhibitions, and so on. And in doing so, to create and disseminate a set of ideas which in their different ways extend, reframe, or radicalise practice. In doing this, they additionally create a model of theatre education which values skills, creativity, analysis. In a number of cases, these practitioner theorists also contribute to a significant rethinking of the narratives of theatre history, developing arguments, for instance, that we can understand the history and development of theatre by examining its visual and spatial strategies as well as its texts. Collectively, they all demonstrate in the first half of the 20th century that the development of the art of the theatre will rest on a far-reaching re-examination of the hierarchies which informed the 19th century. Aside from Appiah, who, as Simonson recognises, perhaps begins this process, we might include Robert Edmund Jones, Mordecai Gorelick, Simonson himself, all in America, Oscar Schlemmer in Germany, Terence Gray in England, and of course Craig himself, who interestingly, and I think importantly in the context of modernism more broadly, was perhaps the most internationalised of them all. He works in Britain, Ireland, Russia, Italy, exhibits across Europe, and is deeply concerned with the highly ritualised symbolic theatre forms and practices which exist outside Europe, for instance, no theatre in Japan. There are others, of course, but it's especially true of these that they attach a real importance to taking their practice into the domains of theory and criticism, and they see an exchange across these domains as important and significant. Of this group, I think it's perhaps Craig and Schlemmer in whom we see the greatest concern to try and frame a new relationship between practice, criticality, and education and training. Through Schlemmer, we encounter the Bauhaus, of course, perhaps the single largest influence on education and practice, and one of the most influential examples of advancing research and knowledge in scenography as part of an educational programme. In Craig, we have a number of influential achieved productions, several key texts, notably those within his book On the Art of the Theatre, and from Craig, one of the first serious journals of theatre and the visual arts, a journal he called The Mask. In formal educational terms, he had plans for his own school of theatre in Italy, short-lived, and of course what he's most famous for, the development of those movable canvas screens, which when articulated within the stage space, create multiple architectonic spaces, transforming the environment in full view of the audience and introducing to scenography a psychokinetic dimension, which can correspond both to the practical needs of performance and the dramatic intention. Of all the early modernist scenographers, and Craig preferred the term the new movement, it seems to me to be Craig who comes closest to defining a unified, radical new manifesto agenda, if you wish, for scenography by triangulating praxis, theory, and education. Craig is continually preoccupied with this triangulation. Writing in 1913 in a publication to celebrate the formation of his school of theatre, he writes about his journal, The Mask, and he says, "The Mask isn't an independent unit, but it's part of a whole. So while we in The Mask say these things, study them, and send news of them to those scattered all over the world are yet in spirit with the movement, the school is practicing, experimenting, giving form and substance to all which The Mask for 6 years has been saying, actualising that for which The Mask has prepared the way. Thus practice and theory and practice, act and react, each confirming and strengthening the other." 2 years earlier, writing in The Art of Theatre, Craig envisaged this action and reaction as an apprenticeship of perhaps 6 to 10 years for what he calls the young athletes of the theatre, a kind of 360-degree immersive apprenticeship, studying each of the distinctive roles and areas of theatre-making, scenic art, acting, management, costuming, and so on, each individually, before being able to determine how to perfectly balance these elements. In the same publication, he considers the importance of a school of theatre, distinct from the world of practice, which can dedicate itself somewhat in isolation to experimentation. So in Craig, we have one of the first attempts to completely reframe how we define theatre and the means by which it's understood and taught. For me, these radical idealist essays mark out the essential characteristics, the problematic, if you like, of modern scenography. And in doing so, they open the way for a theatre of movement, form, and colour, and therefore for the subsequent blending of hitherto discrete forms, dance, physical and visual theatre, puppetry and mask work. I want to spend a few minutes illuminating Craig's radicalism by spending some time considering the theatre practice he's emerging from. So here are a pair of images separated by 15 years. On the right is Craig, photographed in Italy in 1912 in his school. It's around the time of the second publication of The Art of Theatre, and also around the time that his screens are being made use of in Dublin, as Christopher referred to. On the other side is a drawing by William Telbin from 1895. Essentially, it's a self-portrait of the eminent London scenic artist who was working actually at the Lyceum during the time that we were just talking about. So I'm going to try and use these images to discuss something of this radical change, which I think Craig is setting in motion. Writing in the Magazine of Art in 1895, in the midst of Victorian pictorialism on the stage, Telbin writes a careful description of the duties and responsibilities familiar to him and his contemporaries. He says, "We must do or try to do any commission that is offered to us. Although not beggars in the nature of things, we can't be choosers. The play is suggested by the painter. He receives the subject from the dramatist." He goes on, "Personally, I prefer sea, rocks and ruins, but I seldom have an opportunity of indulging my predilections, so our tastes must be cosmopolitan." His essay continues with a careful account of the process of arriving at the organisation and design of scenery. Crucially, his concerns, and these are perfectly common and fully accepted within the period, are that design should as closely as possible refer to a heightened, dramatised, but essentially natural representation of the location in question as specified by the dramatist. This is to be substantially achieved by the complex mix of backcloths, cut cloths, gauzes, supplemented by three-dimensional or modelled scenery as required. Telbin doesn't stray from the general acceptance that the role of the scenic artist is rooted in this tradition of pictorialism, and for all its differences to easel painting, it is essentially an applied version of the landscape and architectural painting of the Academy. Telbin goes on with a description of the design process when he writes, "The uninitiated in the affairs of the theatrical world would be greatly amused to see the collection of miscellaneous articles in modelling that are scattered around us. Bits of silk, gelatine, tissue paper, muslin, coal birch, brooms, plaster of Paris, books, sticks, and the indispensable glue pot. Photographs, tools, colour box and scissors. With coal and plaster we construct our rocks and beetling crags. From selected portions of the broom dipped in and modelled with plaster, we construct our trees, clothe in verdure our hillsides, and with silk, coloured gelatine, and so on, we make our atmosphere. And night and day is according to the density and colour of the medium in which we clothe it. Over a ledge of rock pours a torrent of floss silk. The more distant portions are painted. The books, photographs, and sketches furnish us with our authority for detail." "Strange to say," he continues, "no material you may possess, however good, ever fits exactly the requirement or spirit of the subject represented." As an apprentice to his father, William Telbin Sr., R. Telbin was fortunate in receiving a thorough grounding in the expectations and traditions of his art. Telbin considers his own possible inheritors when he goes on to say, "It's often occurred to me that the habit of accepting young men or boys as articled pupils in scene painting isn't quite as it should be. It's neither fair to those who propose a painting as a profession, nor is it to the best interest of our branch of art in the theatre. A preparatory education in art should most certainly precede their technical education in scene painting. Otherwise, in few cases, will any solid foundation will be laid. A superficial dexterity acquired is really all but worthless in competition to those who know thoroughly how to draw and have been taught that there is a difference between the leaf of the oak, the elm, the beech, and the chestnut, and that there is a most obvious distinction between the formation of one rock and that of another." There goes Telbin on rocks again. Telbin's useful, I think, because he presents the practice which Craig seeks to dissolve. Telbin's understanding of scenography and training for scenography is one wherein there is a kind of certainty. It almost seems a hermetically sealed practice. The materials of the stage are those that can facilitate the pictorial and the illusionistic. The terms of reference are those of the painting, and historical accuracy and delineation are the order of the day. The conventions of staging and the knowledge of staging in Telbin's theatre are so thoroughly established that he sees no role in questioning them. For Craig, this must have seemed suffocating. For Telbin, the idea of blank canvas screens must have seemed outrageous, a slap in the face, a denial of everything he stood for and worked for. Where's Craig in relationship to this? Telbin situates himself firmly in the scene shop. His model is a brief intermediate step before he begins the task of tackling those giant pictorial canvases. Telbin's model box, it seems to me, is there to confirm what the painter and the theatre manager already suspect about the play from their knowledge of it. For Telbin, there is no need to discuss what the spaces of the play mean. They're locations for the action, a landscape, a castle. Atmospheric, certainly, exquisitely achieved and powerful, but they're concerned with the surface of the world of the play, its external appearance. Telbin, it seems to me, is absolutely the theatre artisan, a highly skilled craftsman working within a carefully delineated context. When Craig pictures himself, and I suspect he was a man who took great care of how he was photographed, we see a very different idea. This is not the designer as a craftsman or as a scenic artist or even as a practical person at all. This is the designer as a thinker, a problematizer, as an intellectual. Craig sits in front of his model, wearing his best suit and holding a cigarette, that vital 20th century modernist gestus of the artist in thought. He seems to be considering his achievement and marking how his own personality and presence are integral to understanding and viewing the work. Here is Craig in the act of self-curation. The photograph stages the theatre designer more as a thinker than a maker. The model here is no longer a doll's house, as Craig would have put it, but a place to consider the idea of the text and the possibility of its performance. So in his models, in his drawings, in his writings, we can see how Craig not only unbuckles scenography from the idea of pictorialism, but liberates it to discover its own authenticity. Craigian space, the term he sometimes uses, is architectonic, is not representative or referential of other historical spaces or other imagined spaces. It is a primary, authentic space, the purpose of which is not to represent another reality, but to be in and of itself the dimensionalized world of the play and the world of the protagonist. In Craig's vision, scenography becomes text, able to play against the spoken word and the performance. He uses the term harmony to provide metaphor, symbol, counterpoint. No longer an illustration, now a voicing of dramatic intention and revealing new materialities. The form, the materials, the organisation of space all acknowledge the theatrical environment they operate within and celebrate the possibility of theatre space. Scenography no longer alludes to or infers a space, it is the space. Craig, therefore, provides us with the means of seeing scenography as the coining of concept. After Craig, scenography is released as a completely creative art form which can define its own boundaries and its own limitations. Central to this is the idea of speculation, that the creative and intellectual process of scenography can be profitably conducted, in fact should be conducted, outside of the problem of actually producing a piece of theatre. The problems of form, colour, composition and movement can be considered and rehearsed in the abstract as two-dimensional renderings, as spatial propositions or models, and as experimental works intended to explore key technical or creative ideas. These works can be considered as related to, but distinct from, the instrumentalised versions of such processes, which are necessarily part of a production regime. They can enable a deeper understanding of text, of space, and so on, and they provide an iterative means of engaging with the idea of performance. They allow the rehearsal of concepts and the perfecting, or at least distillation, of thinking. They can reasonably be considered complete in themselves. These works are certainly preparations for practice, but most importantly, they allow an aesthetic to be built and tested outside of the practical demands of realisation. In a way, they are a necessary elevation, up and out of reality, an opportunity to construct a higher viewpoint. This idea is central to the education of theatre designers. There must be times when there is no limit to the space, no gravity, only imagination. The synthesis which Craig sought, the mutuality of elements, if you like, presents an interesting and ongoing thematic for the teaching of theatre, and certainly for the teaching of scenography. The new coherence which Craig seeks creates the problematic which theatre design education will wrestle with throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century. Where do you teach it? In the art school, the drama school, the university? Each of these institutions privileges different groups and different specialisms. Each of them negotiates different proximities to the performer and to theatrical space. Certainly, Craig's approach is highly enabling in terms of the art school environment, because so much of his concern rests on the designer's ability to pre-sense and pre-plan what is going to happen at the moment of performance. In Craig's method, the model and the drawing, the two prompts for the event itself, take on the potency of the individual art object, no longer only part of the instrumentation of the design process, but a site for the working through of dramatic intention. In parallel to Craig's own plans for a school, the shape of educational opportunity in the visual arts was by the turn of the century transforming too. Certainly by 1911, the development of municipal art schools throughout the UK is underway. Birmingham is arguably the first around 1877, but we quickly see other major cities following suit. By the early 20th century, it seems to me that we begin to see the opportunity for a training in the arts and the applied arts, which moves out of the workplace or the studio and into a formal educational setting. We see the atelier system and the apprenticeship as a means of entering arts practice added to through these forms, and the development of a wholly new situation and set of opportunities for arts education. This is Guildhall in the 1940s, as a matter of interest. This new arrangement will ultimately lead via the art schools, the technical colleges, the conservatoires and the universities to the current situation we have today. Crucially, for the study of theatre design, we find it located in art schools, drama schools, universities, technical colleges, which later become polytechnics, and then, of course, the new universities. So we can see that as educational opportunity grows and changes, theatre finds itself across multiple domains of study and viewed from multiple perspectives, according to the institution it's within, and each of these in the ebb and flow of scholarly inquiry, professional preoccupation, style, and a host of other pressures and influences will adapt how it approaches and teaches the subject. What we see when we look at Craig's writing about education is a sense that the need for both a kind of apprenticeship or an atelier experience and the need to work at a remove from practice. His own curriculum and faculty structure is worth considering. He writes of his school. The school consists of two separate bodies. One body, styled the First Division, is composed of workers and teachers who are at the same time students of Mr. Craig's methods and who experiment under his direction. Amongst these are musicians, electricians, woodcarvers, modellers, designers, photographers, crucially, scene painters, carpenters, and so on, each of whom teaches the other something of his own particular craft and who is himself taught something by the others. The other body is known as the Second Division, and it's composed of paying students who learn various crafts from the teachers and workers in the First Division. These students are expected to have a good general knowledge and must be of proved capacity before they will be allowed to join the school. The inclusion of photographers is very interesting here. I think this is the generation of designers who first begin to cope with the whole problem of ephemerality around their practice. Craig goes on to discuss his curriculum. He says, the workers and experimenters in the First Division give a portion of their time to teaching each other and a portion to teaching the pupils in the Second Division. No pupil is admitted who doesn't reach the high standard of efficiency required by the regulations. The type of pupil desired is the young man, and he's interested entirely in recruiting young men, of public school or university education. He will be taught what he's not learned before, namely a general course in the arts and crafts, which should round off and complete him mentally and physically. All pupils take up the study of speech and movement, and if any student has a talent for or a desire to learn any special craft, he'll be given the opportunity. The subjects in the curriculum are as follows: gymnastics, music, voice training, scene designing and painting, costume designing and making, modelling, fencing, dancing, mimo drama, improvisation, lighting theory, history of the theatre, marionette designing, making and performing, stage model making, all of which are part and parcel of what Craig calls stage managing. The last section of Craig's discussion of the curriculum may be of particular interest to anybody currently working in education. He says, a quantity of pupils is not wanted. The choice will be rigorously confined to selecting out of every 20 or 30 talented and educated men who apply, one or two who satisfy the director's requirements. That takes me back. The one or two students that Craig envisaged isn't so many fewer than were envisaged as theatre design began to find its place in art and drama schools in England. The London Theatre Studio under Michel Saint-Denis and the design team of Motley was perhaps the first drama school in Britain by 1935 to incorporate theatre design, only a few years behind Wimbledon College of Art, who by 1932 had introduced design as a subject. Here we are. These two educational developments are significant because in broad terms they capture the binary nature of theatre design education and that ongoing question of where should theatre design be studied. Is it rightly part of the larger domain of drama, or is it better facilitated within the fine arts where its visual priorities can be established? Craig, of course, requires that all theatre students are taught together. This is his ground plan for his theatre school, and it remains a significant issue as to whether the increasing fragmentation of the subject of theatre into domains, lighting, costume interpretation and so on, as has been common in the UK in the search for ever greater specialism and focus, will provide theatre with future generations of visionaries, or whether this increasingly instrumentalised view of education will ultimately inhibit the single authorial vision Craig sought. Craig's second thought, which I alluded to in the title, was to dedicate on the art of the theatre, not to the young race of athletic workers, but, as he says, to the single courageous individuality in the world of theatre who will someday master and remould it. There are many notable contemporary scenographers who have certainly recognised their debt to Craig and whose models of creative practice closely resemble his. Robert Page, Robert Wilson quickly come to mind, but one might as easily cite Peter Brook. Frank Chamberlain, in his introduction to the 2008 edition of On the Art of Theatre, additionally cites people like Pina Bausch, Goat Island and DV8. These and many others have directly benefited from the disruption Craig brought about and the spirit of highly disciplined restlessness which he espoused. As Craig so readily understood, and Michael Walton points out in Craig on Theatre, the practice of theatre can sometimes be unequal to the idea. The same, I think, can be said of education. So many of Craig's detractors, significant achievers such as Simonson, now seem bounded by their achievement. Craig's elusive, problematic challenges to practice still in a remarkable way seem vivid and prophetic. Perhaps his greatest legacy is not in the achievement of his essays or the handful of productions, but in his endless ability to challenge us to go higher, ever higher, that we should never be satisfied with what we have. As the fundamental properties of sonography now extend into the multiple digital practice of games design, interactive computing, augmented reality, and so on, we can arrive at a temporary response to his demand for change, to be ever renewing. But these are only temporary. And in another 100 years, I suspect we'll be equally annoyed, fascinated, inspired, and confounded by Craig. Certainly one of the prime sonographers, Craig is an artist who saw that to identify the right questions to ask was always going to be of greater importance than providing answers which could only be for the moment. Craig's reputation as a designer is certainly not wholly positive. His technical understanding has often been heavily criticised, and all the most told stories about Craig are of supposed failings. Did you know his scenery fell down? It never really worked. They had to cut 6 feet off it to get it into the venue and so on. This is to miss the point of Craig's importance. It's not relevant that in performance terms the technology of his scenography was problematic. His primary domain as an artist is in the imaginative space between text, design and direction. His ability is to pre-sense the poetics of performance in writing, in sculpture, and in drawing. Craig's legacy is to unbuckle theatre and theatre design in particular from the practical and the conventionalised, and to make a place in the speculative, a space of philosophical reflection, a place devoted to creativity. I'll leave the final words to Craig. From the index to his days, he says, "We impossibles were gifted beings, but useless to the world. People were always asking us to be practical. They wanted to stop being ourselves so markedly. I was one of the impossibles and became in time one of the leaders. The impossibles are the impenitent independents, the true rebels, they who come to rebel because born to do so."